Okay, good morning everybody. It is about 2:31 and it is April 27th, Wednesday. That means that next class period you have a test, lecture test. And let's see if I have the syllabus. Oh, by the way, here's a sign-in sheet. Go ahead, grab that, pass it around. Sign in, please. So let's see what's going to be on that lecture test. Where's the latest and greatest syllabus at? Why don't I have it? I guess this works just fine. All right, so don't forget, heart. On the syllabus, I have it as chapter 18, but it's actually 19. So the exam chapters will be what? Central nervous system, peripheral nervous system, autonomic nervous system, special senses, and heart. So I believe that is chapter 13, 14, 15, 16, and 19. Right? That's the deal. Okay. All right. So that is next time. So make sure you bring in a picture ID too next time, because I haven't been checking that, but I have to start checking that. So if you have that Cypress College picture ID, that's great. If not, a driver's license or something. All right, so we were in the circulatory system chapter last time, and I think we covered pulmonary circulation, but I think you're familiar with all the different circulations. We got done with the heart, spent a lot of time with the heart. So just to kind of lead us into circulations, how many chambers does the heart have? How many valves does the heart have? And how many sides does the heart have? Two. Okay, and how many circulations does the heart have? Two, right? So the heart has two different sides, the right side and left side, because there are two circulations. The right side pumps blood through the pulmonary circulation, the left side pumps blood through the systemic circulation. Okay, and so for the pulmonary circulation, it's not very difficult, but that comes out of the right ventricle into the pulmonary trunk, and then the pulmonary trunk bifurcates. The right pulmonary artery goes underneath the arch of the aorta, while the left pulmonary just shoots right over directly to the lung. The big difference right here is that you should realize that the relationship of the pulmonary circulation to the systemic circulation in terms of what kind of blood is that it's carrying is what? Is opposite each other. So it's very possible to have a vein that's carrying relatively oxygenated blood, right? We find that in the pulmonary veins. And how would you define a vein? By the material that it's carrying, or what? Only the direction of the flow of blood. If it's away from the heart, it is called an artery. If it's bringing blood back to the heart, it's a vein. And it can be either oxygenated or deoxygenated, depending on whether it's pulmonary circulation or systemic circulation. Okay, so let's move to the systemic circulation. Oh, but before I get there, I just want to make sure that you all should be able to trace a drop of blood through the circulation, both circulations, labeling all chambers, all valves and arteries, okay, and veins, make sure you know that, and also the state of oxygenation in those various structures. All right, so systemic circulation. In the systemic circulation, what do arteries carry? They carry blood away from the heart, but is it What's the material there? Is it relatively high in oxygen or low in oxygen? Systemic is high in oxygen. Absolutely right. Is it true for every systemic artery? It's going to be high in oxygen. Every systemic artery high in oxygen? I would say yes. Could you give me an example of a systemic artery where it is low in oxygen? Only the capillary is not an artery though, okay? Only the pulmonary arteries are relatively low in oxygen, but every systemic artery is high in oxygen, every pulmonary artery is relatively low. Okay, so if that's not making sense, you got to go back and draw the circulations and also write it out in word form like we did on the board last time and as we're doing in lab. Okay, so let's go to the systemic circulation, and here is the whole systemic circulation, and these are arteries because they're in red. Veins are not on this diagram right here, just for simplification. And I think we kind of gone over some of these things in lab. But the left ventricle pumps blood past what? The pole, the aortic semilunar valve into the aorta. And what is this first division of the aorta called? Anybody remember this right here? This is the ascending aorta, and then it makes a hairpin turn. Here's the arch of the aorta, and then after the arch, you then get into the descending aorta, which means that there's a division in the thorax, and there's a division in the abdomen, and that is separated by the diaphragm, of course. Right? So thoracic aorta is part of the descending. Abdominal aorta is part of the descending aorta as well. What direction is blood flowing in the aorta? I'm just checking to see if you guys are there. It is what? Away from the heart, right? Okay. All right, so let's look at the first branches. The first branch is off the aorta. And this is kind of a trick question. Okay, what could somebody guess what the first branches off the aorta are? And it's really kind of a trick question. Okay, because you see the brachiocephalic, but I want to caution you, that's not the first branch off the aorta. That certainly is the first branch off the arch, but what about the heart itself? Does it need oxygen and nutrients to stay alive? Absolutely. So what do we call arteries that actually feed the heart oxygen? Coronary arteries, right? So don't forget about those coronary arteries that branch off the ascending aorta, right at the root of the ascending aorta. As a matter of fact, right within the cusps of the aortic semilunar valve. You have the left and right coronary arteries. Okay. But then when we get into the arch, the first branch is the brachiocephalic. That just means what? Going to the arm as well as to the head. Brachio means toward the arm. Cephalic means toward the head. So it's a common trunk that takes blood to the right side of the body via the right subclavian here or the right common carotid. The next branch is just the left common carotid taking blood to the head. And then the third branch off the arch is the left subclavian. Then that turns into the axillary. And once it's in the arm, that's the brachial, same vessel, just given a different name because it's in a different region of the body. Just like one of your favorite streets changes names when you go from one town to another. What's a good example of that? But I can't quite hear if you had a good example. Give me the name of a street that changes names. Like Lincoln, what does it change into? Carson, as you get into Long Beach, right? So same thing here with these blood vessels. The name just changes, but basically it's the same vessel, just in a different region of town, so to speak. Okay, I want to stay with the head a little bit. So we say that the common carotid is bringing blood to the head. That's a very important organ up there. Probably one of your favorite ones, which is the brain, right? So, and the brain needs a constant supply of oxygen. And remember, the brain will become unconscious if we cut off blood for how long? A measly 2 or 3 seconds, you'll lose consciousness, right? And then the brain dies after about 2 or 3 minutes. Okay, so the carotids are very important. But there are other blood vessels that bring blood to the vein. Here is a subclavian. A branch, one of the first branches off the subclavian right here is called the vertebral artery. And this artery right here goes through the vertebral foramina of the cervical vertebrae. Can you remember, where is a vertebral foramen at? It's in a cervical vertebrae. What part of a cervical vertebrae? Is it a body or a spinous process or where? It's the transverse processes have foramina for this particular blood vessel right here, which is called the vertebral foramen. Okay. All right, so I want to move on to the head. So let me get a picture of a head a little bit so we can see some of these blood vessels in the head. Ah, here's a really good diagram of a head. All right, so here is the aortic arch. Here's the brachiocephalic trunk. And then here's the subclavian. And then here's the common carotid. And the first branch off of the subclavian is this vertebral artery. And on this slide, you can actually see it going through what? The transverse foramina of the cervical vertebrae. And this is going to bring blood to inside the cranial vault. The carotid will take blood to the outside of the cranium as well as the inside after this bifurcation right here. So here is the external carotid taking blood to superficial structures in the head, and then here is the internal carotid, which is bringing blood to the brain. So that's probably the more important of the two, I suppose, if you're going to consider that. This region right here, probably should draw this in, this is the carotid sinus. And you can see it kind of looks like a little bulge in the carotid artery, and there are important sensors for blood pressure as well as chemicals that are in the blood, like CO2 and pH. So the carotid sinus is right here at the bifurcation of the common carotid and the internal and external carotid arteries. So that's a very important location. And just because of that little bulge, it produces a lot of stress in this region of a blood vessel. And so this region right here actually becomes diseased in a lot of people, the carotid sinus. And it can generate plaques or thrombi, which then can go up to the brain and cause a stroke. So that's a really serious issue, of course. So this region right here is probably the most commonly imaged area on anybody's body because it's so commonly diseased due to arterial sclerosis or other kinds of pathology, maybe due to diabetes, mellitus, or hypertension as well. And they image it just with ultrasound, with just a nice ultrasound device on the neck. It can be imaged very, very nicely. Okay, so who's got a question on the carotid artery so far? All right, can you name two blood vessels that bring blood to the brain? How about the internal carotid and the vertebral? Those are two. And of course, you have one on the other side. They're bilaterally arranged. All right, let me find another picture of the underside of the brain right here. Okay, so this is where the internal carotid arteries, right, start to feed the brain right here and right here. All right, and then here we see the vertebral arteries here and here. And as they ascend into the brain, the vertebral arteries, anastomose, they join together to form the basilar artery. And notice something else that's special. We see a little circle right here, right at the base of the brain, right around the optic chiasm, right past the mammillary bodies. Right? It kind of reminds me of a nerve plexus. What's the beauty of a nerve plexus? And it's the beauty of this structure right here as well. What's the importance of a nerve plexus? Yeah, if a nerve is damaged, if it's part of a nerve plexus, you still might be able to bring important nerve impulses to an important organ because it can take an alternate route to get to that vital organ through a nerve plexus. The same thing for this structure right here is what we call the circle of Willis. Okay? For instance, if the carotid artery, internal carotid artery, were to become occluded, right, the whole side of the brain over here would actually die, and there'd be no chance anybody could survive that. Right? But because of the circle of Willis, even though there is an occlusion of one internal carotid artery, right, blood can go from the other internal carotid via the circle of Willis over to the other side of the brain, thereby sparing brain death on a whole side of the brain. Right? And the same thing, if this carotid is occluded, blood supply via these two vertebral arteries, via the basilar artery right here, can still also feed both sides of the brain if there is a partial blockage. So the circle of Willis is really important because it allows for redistribution of blood to the whole brain, even though one or more of these important arteries might become occluded or partially occluded. All right, so that's why I have these asterisks in your lecture notes right here. Vertebral arteries got these asterisks, and the internal carotid has them because they anastomose to form the circle of Willis. So blood can actually go from the right to the left side via the circle of Willis if one of these blood vessels becomes occluded. All right, so it's no big deal. If one vertebral gets occluded, the whole brain can still receive blood from both carotids and the vertebral on the other side. All right, the carotids are so big that if one is completely occluded, that will still cause problems. You can't redistribute enough blood to maintain complete health on that side of the brain, but at least probably you'll prevent it from dying anyway until it can be revascularized with some kind of surgical procedure. All right, so that's the beauty of the circle of Willis right there. All right, so let's go down to some extremities. Well, I think this is pretty easy. We probably actually have done this already in lab. Okay, so going from extremity, you have the subclavians, right? then becoming the axillary in the armpit region, brachial in the arm, and then that bifurcates into the radial and ulnar arteries, right? Until you get down into the palm of the hand, then we have the palmar arches right here. Right, so those are some things that you have to know. Thoracic aorta. All right, as we work our way down to the lower extremity, let's look at the descending aorta through the thorax and abdomen, and especially the abdomen. So here we see a bunch of blood vessels. All right, so here is the diaphragm, and here is the opening in the diaphragm for the esophagus, because it's going to take material from the esophagus into the stomach, which is about in this region right here. And so that's what we call the esophageal hiatus, right? It's just an opening in the diaphragm, right? And we see a bunch of blood vessels. And when we analyze blood vessels coming off the abdominal aorta, sometimes there are blood vessels that come off in pairs, and sometimes there is a blood vessel that just comes off as a single unit, not as a paired unit, right? And why do you think that is? It has to do with the organs, right? Some organs you have two copies of. You have a right and a left, like you have a left and a right kidney right here, so it has its own blood supply. So here is the left and right renal artery taking blood to the kidneys. Other organs you only have one of. Who can name an organ that you only have one of? Like the spleen and stomach and liver, for instance, you only have one. They come off of arteries that is just a single branch. So we have paired branches and unpaired branches coming off the abdominal aorta. And let's look at the unpaired branches first. The first one, right below the diaphragm, this is what we call the celiac trunk. So that's just a single artery, and then it's going to bifurcate into the hepatic that goes over to the liver. I don't think I have that in your notes to know, and it's not labeled on this diagram. Then you have a gastric and a splenic that goes to the spleen that's over here. The gastric, where does the gastric artery go to? It goes to the stomach, okay, and you only have one of each of these organs, but those all originate from the celiac trunk. And then a little bit inferior to that or distal to that is the superior mesenteric, and then even more distal to that, a small inferior mesenteric artery. And mesenteries are just the membrane systems that hold your intestines and abdominal viscera in position, and they're loaded with blood vessels that come from these arteries right here. All right, so is that difficult to see? The first thing you got to memorize is what? The first unpaired branch is the celiac trunk, and then the remaining two are the superior mesenteric and inferior mesenteric. The others that I want you to know are paired branches, and I think I got three that you should be aware of. Maybe two. Okay, what do I have? I've got three. Okay, that's good, because your book has them. So here, the most proximal are the arteries that go to the adrenal glands. And because they are superior to the kidney, right, they lie above them, or cranial to the kidney, that's why we call it suprarenal, just means on top of the kidney. So here are the adrenal glands. So here is the right and left suprarenal artery, or adrenal arteries, you could call them. And then you've got the left and right renal arteries, and then you got these two right over here just below the superior mesenteric artery, comes off as a paired branch. These are the gonadal arteries. So what's a gonad again? I think you guys told me in lab you knew what that was. What was that? Either an ovary or a testes, right? And most people have two copies of those. And so if it's a male, this gonadal artery goes all the way down through the inguinal canal, inguinal ligament to the testes, which is in the scrotum. But if it's a female, it just goes to an ovary that's in the pelvic cavity. Not quite so long. All right, so that's the abdominal aorta and some important branches off of it. And then the aorta bifurcates. It becomes the common iliac. And then the common iliacs bifurcate into the external and internal. And so we'll have to go to a little bit different slide to see that. Probably the big slide right here is good for showing that. All right, so here's common iliac, here is internal, and then here is external. The external then turns into the femoral, and then behind the knee it's the popliteal. And which other ones you have to know? Ah, that's it. Okay, so that's pretty easy. All right, so for the arteries, this pretty much parallels what you had to know in lab. And the venous system, the vessels of the veins, pretty much are named after the names of the arteries in that region of the body. There's just a couple exceptions. So let's maybe look at a couple of these exceptions. Before I switch, how many brachiocephalic arteries do we have? How many brachiocephalic arteries do we have? Ah, there's only one. So there's some asymmetry coming off the arch of the aorta. That's sort of interesting, right? So you only have a brachiocephalic. So we don't say right or left brachiocephalic because we all know it's on the right side of the body, feeding the right side of the head and the right arm via the right subclavian, okay? But that's a brachiocephalic. But now in terms of the veins, guess what? We have two brachiocephalics. All right, so now we don't see arteries on this diagram. We only see veins. All right, and leading right into the heart, we have the superior vena cava and then inferior vena cava all the way through the thorax and abdomen. And here is one division that's draining blood back from the left arm and the left side of the head. So it is what? Both brachial and cephalic. So here is the left brachiocephalic, and then over here we see the right brachiocephalic, which is after the anastomosis of the jugular and subclavian veins over here. So you got two brachiocephalic veins, only one brachiocephalic artery. What drains blood back from the head are the jugular veins, okay? And then you have subclavian, okay? Then cephalic, brachial, and basilar veins that are in the arm. And I think we covered these things in lab. So I'm not too concerned with going over these things, but I do want to go over some things in the head. All right, so what circulation do these blood vessels that I'm showing you, which circulation do they belong to? How many circulations are there? Two major circulations. What are their names? Pulmonary and systemic. So which one are these right here? Could these be pulmonary? Absolutely not, because you don't see any lungs, right? So this has to be the systemic venous system right here. So what is the state of blood in systemic veins? Is it high in oxygen or low? In a systemic vein, it is low in oxygen. It's low in oxygen. But pulmonary vein is what? High in oxygen. Don't forget, they're opposite each other. Pulmonary and systemic are opposite each other. It's real important for you to understand, like, the fetal circulation, right? How that works. All right, so before you answer that, think about it. Think it through. Or go back and look at those. Okay. As far as draining blood back from the brain, okay, there aren't many blood vessels in the brain proper, right? Blood drains back into very small veins and then collects in something that we call a sinus, right? And again, a sinus is just one of these terms that's used a lot in anatomy. It has a lot of different meanings. Like a sinus could contain air and lymphatic tissue, like for the paranasal sinuses. Okay, these particular sinuses right here actually contain venous blood being drained back from the brain. So right on midline, here's the superior sagittal sinus. And how do I know this is right on midline? Because that's in the name, right? Sagittal just means, especially if we were to say mid-sagittal sinus, okay? And then that drains blood down over here into the confluence of the sinuses because there is a straight sinus that is lateral that joins the sagittal sinus, and then we have the sigmoid sinus right here, draining even a lot more blood, and eventually that's going to drain into the jugular vein, back to the brachiocephalic vein. Okay, so these sinuses here don't contain air or cerebrospinal fluid, they contain blood coming back from the brain. Okay, and of course, these all pass through the jugular foramen, and you could probably draw that out where that is, where that jugular foramen is. And is that a big foramen in the cranium, or is that a relatively small one? Can you remember what the size of the jugular was, if you had an impression? Compared to like the olfactory foramina, or foramen spinosum, jugular is huge. The jugular foramen is huge. Not as big as the foramen magnum, but it's still a huge foramen because this jugular vein is huge because of all the blood that's being drained back from the brain. Okay. Lower appendage. Though you had to know these for lab, so I'm not going to go over these things because there's some more important things that we want to talk about. Okay. Let's talk about the usual kind of circulatory pattern that we find in the circulatory system. What kind of vessel brings blood away from the heart. An artery. Yes, vein, artery. That's right. Very good. It's an artery. It takes blood away from the heart. Okay. And then there's another blood vessel that brings blood back to the heart, and that's what we call a vein. And then you've got other kinds of blood vessels that are in between the two. And what do we call those? Capillaries, right? And they neither take blood away from the heart or to the heart, because that's the job of an artery or vein. But nonetheless, they have a very special function, and that is exchange, because they're thin. They only have the tunica intima, that endothelial layer, so they're very, very thin. And then some capillaries are leaky, more leaky than others, so you should know the three types of capillaries. So here's the typical kind of circulation, where you have an artery, and it feeds one capillary bed, blood goes through one capillary bed, and then it enters a vein, and then it goes back to the heart. So you've got what? Artery, capillary, and vein. But every once in a while, in a few locations in your body, you don't have that usual circulatory system. You have something that looks like this. Right? You have a big blood vessel. So here is an artery taking blood away from the heart. So up over here, I've got the heart, right, pumping blood into this. This is an artery. Okay, and then this artery is going to feed a capillary bed that I'm going to draw with a bunch of these arcing lines right here. So here's a capillary. What's happening in this capillary? Things are going in and out, and you guys said it correctly, so there is exchange. The usual circulation then, what would happen to this blood after this capillary? It would go back to the heart via what kind of structure? A vein. Okay, but every once in a while, instead of going into a vein, it goes into a blood vessel that takes it to a second capillary bed. All right, so here is capillary bed number one. Here is capillary bed number two. And this vessel between the two capillary beds is called a portal blood vessel or a portal vein. Portal vein right here. And this is just a special delivery system that can pick up compounds in this capillary bed and deliver it to a second tissue over here where it leaves before it gets dumped into the circulation again. Or maybe things are taken out, okay, and put in over here, either way. Okay, so here there are two capillary beds, and then after the second capillary bed, where does it go? Into a vein, which goes where? Back to the heart. So this is a portal circulation. And here is a special portal, here's a list of three of them. The hepatic portal system. Where would you look for that? What organ would you look for? Around the liver someplace. Here's another one. In the nephron, there's a portal system. We're going to find that when we look at the kidney coming up in a couple weeks. And then here's one that we looked at already. Okay, between the hypothalamus and the pituitary gland. Right, so a hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal system. Another name for pituitary is hypophysis. Hypothalamic just means what? The hypothalamus, so there is a special portal system there. So you might have to go back to the endocrine chapter to take a look at that. This one is a special delivery system that takes very small concentrations of hormones from the hypothalamus and delivers them directly to the pituitary gland without being diluted into the rest of the circulation. All right, but what I want to show you right here is the hepatic portal system and why it is there. All right, so if we start with blood that's in the gastrointestinal tract capillaries, all right, so what can you tell me about these capillaries right here? Exchange. So what's happening? What are these capillaries picking up? It's around the gastrointestinal tract. Basically nutrients or anything that you've had in your diet, right? So it's whatever you're digesting and absorbing into your body get absorbed by these capillaries. And then they go into the gastric vein, for instance. Where is that around? That's around the stomach, right? And then that's going to anastomose and go into the superior mesenteric vein. Maybe some from the inferior mesenteric vein and even the splenic vein. But now the things that we have in our diet might be harmful to our body. There are a lot of toxins. There's preservatives and things like that that could have a deleterious effect on our brain and our consciousness. So the blood doesn't go back to the heart, which then would go to the brain. This blood right here goes to the liver, which is a hepatic, which is the portal system. So capillary bed number one will be around the intestines, and then it goes into a portal system that takes it to the liver, where there is a second set of capillaries, and this is where the liver can detoxify all those nasty things that we have in our diet, or sometimes it can. Okay, so it's a special delivery system to the liver so that those compounds that are in our diet can be detoxified or neutralized. So capillary bed 1 is in the gastrointestinal tract, capillary bed 2 is in the liver, and the vessel that connects these two capillary beds is the hepatic portal vein. And as this blood is leaving the gastrointestinal tract, does it go back to the heart before it goes to the liver? Does it go back to the heart before the liver? So let's just say this is going to correspond to our diagram right here. Here we have the GI tract. And here we have capillary bed 2 is the liver. So my question is, the blood coming from the gastrointestinal tract, does it go back to the heart before the liver? No, it goes to the liver first to be detoxified, and then back to the heart to join the rest of the circulation. Okay, so after the liver capillaries, then it goes into hepatic veins, then into the inferior vena cava, and the inferior vena cava takes blood where? To the right atrium. Okay, so you guys should have notes of all of these things already. Okay, so that's a portal circulation, has two capillary beds back to back instead of just a single one, and here are the three examples of where you would find that in this particular course. Okay, so don't forget, a portal system is what? A special delivery system for blood. So it could deliver hormones or it could detoxify blood. Okay, review fetal circulation. We've done that in lab. If somebody has a question, maybe I'll go over that a little bit, but I probably won't spend a whole lot of time on fetal circulation right now. There's one lab that hasn't looked at fetal circulation yet, but we'll do that today after lecture. But just to give you an idea of the fetal circulation, for those of you that have lab this afternoon, let's just forget about fetal circulation for a second and think about adult circulation. And I always start with, how many chambers does a heart have? 4, that's pretty boring. How many valves does a heart have? There's 4, you're bored with that already. How many sides does the heart have? It's got 2 because why? There are 2 circulations. What are the 2 circulations? Pulmonary and systemic, right? Which one goes to the lungs? The pulmonary circulation. And why is blood going to the lungs? To pick up oxygen, right? And to get rid of CO2. Okay, now if we think of a fetus, of course they have lungs, and they probably breathe a little bit, okay, when they're in utero, but is there, and they're breathing amniotic fluid, but is there any oxygen in amniotic fluid? There really isn't. So the fetus is not using the lungs to oxygenate their blood. They need oxygen, however, otherwise they're going to die. Where do they get oxygen from? Yeah, an organ that an adult doesn't have, and that is the placenta. So the placenta is doing the job of the lungs for the fetus. So you should think of the umbilical circulation or the placental circulation as being what? Part of the systemic or really the pulmonary circulation? It's really like the pulmonary circulation. So an umbilical artery, which is taking blood to the placenta, should it be relatively high or low in oxygen? Just like the pulmonary trunk, it should be relatively low in oxygen. Low in oxygen because it's going to the placenta to do what? To pick up oxygen, just like the pulmonary artery is what? Low in oxygen because it's going to the lungs to do what? Pick up oxygen. Right, so I know it's kind of a mind teaser. You have to think about that one. All right, but if you can think of the fetal circulation as being similar to the pulmonary circulation, then you'll have a pretty good understanding of fetal circulation. But in lab, we'll look at these particular structures. Okay. All right, so what about this chapter right here? Is this going to be on the test on Monday? No, because we stopped at the heart. All right, so this is going to be on your last test, which we call the final, and the final in here is not a cumulative test, right? It just covers starting with this chapter to the end of the class. And I think now this is what, chapter 20. It's no longer called chapter 19, all right? So this is not on the test. And I'm seriously thinking about making the final cumulative, not for your class, but for subsequent classes. Now, why would I even think of mentioning that to you? Why? And this is an important take-home message. And that is, this is a really important class, and it's information that you shouldn't forget because you'll be using it all the time. Okay, so when you're done with this class, you should look over your books and try to remember everything that you learned because it will be important in a physiology class, believe it or not. So even though you've taken a test and you've gotten a grade for that material, you still cannot forget it, right? And if you're forgetting it, you got to go back and use it somehow, all right, so that you don't forget it by the time you go to a physiology class, or if you get a job in medicine, you'll want to know all of this stuff. So I actually feel bad that it's not a cumulative final, but you should pretend like it is, okay, after the class is over. All right, so we're done with this particular chapter. Unless there's some questions. Anybody have a question on a fetal a portal circulation or any of that? You're pretty good. An arteriole? Yeah. So is this what you're interested in right here? Oh, the one I have on the board. Okay. Okay, so here you have an artery coming down from the heart. That's an artery because it's taking blood away from the heart. And it goes into an arteriole and then eventually into a capillary. The usual circulation is like the slide that I'm showing, where you have one capillary bed. And then after the capillary goes into a vein and it takes it back to the heart. But on this diagram right here, right, I see not one capillary bed, I see two. And it's not just one big long one. There are two individual capillary beds and it can be in two different organs. It could be in the stomach and then liver, which are pretty far apart. And this blood vessel that connects the two capillary beds is what we call a portal blood vessel. So exchange cannot happen in a portal vein or portal blood vessel. Exchange can only happen where? In a capillary. So things can be absorbed in capillary bed number one and then special delivered to capillary bed number two, where they can leak out and the liver can process them by detoxifying or modifying those compounds. And then after that, it goes back to a vein. And the definition of a vein is what? It takes blood back to the heart. All right, so this little thing is sort of, when we say that a portal vein, that's a little bit of a misnomer because it doesn't take it back to the heart, but it is sort of taking it back on the way to the heart. But it's got to go through what? The second capillary bed first. So these two capillary beds are definitely separated from each other, okay, with a portal blood vessel right there. So is that good? Okay. Okay, so next chapter, lymphatic system. Okay, lymphatic system is a lot like a circulatory system, in a sense. All right, vascular lymphatics. But there's other things to lymphatic system as well, besides vessels. All right, so what's the composition of the lymphatic system? Well, there is fluid, and that is lymph. Let me see, I want to... I want to zoom. Okay. All right, so composition of the lymphatic system. There's lymph, that's a fluid. And blood is a fluid connective tissue. Blood has cells in it. Can anybody tell me the name of a cell that's in blood? Like red blood cells, white blood cells. But there's also a fluid part that separates these red blood cells from each other. Can you remember what that was called way back when? It was like in the first week of lab. You had blood cells and then the fluid part is what we call plasma, right? So lymph is pretty much like plasma. It doesn't contain red blood cells, maybe doesn't contain many white blood cells, but it's mostly made up of stuff that looks like plasma and kind of looks like interstitial fluid. So it has a lot of proteins in it and electrolytes and things like that. Lymphocytes are a kind of white blood cell. And it was one of the kinds of white blood cells I think you had to identify in the slide, a lymphocyte, right? It was the one that the whole cell almost was filled up completely with the nucleus. That was a lymphocyte. And so I'm going to talk about functions in a little bit, so let's not go into that right now. Then you have vessels that carry lymph around in the body. And as lymph is flowing from one part of the body to another, it goes through a lymph node. It goes through a little nodule that's filled with lymphatic tissue that has, guess what, a lot of lymphocytes in it. And a lymph node filters lymph and it's looking for things that don't belong in your body, like bacteria and fungi and things like that, maybe even cancer cells. All right, and tonsils, these are in your pharynx. They help fight infection. The spleen is in the abdominal cavity, and thymus gland is in the mediastinum. And I think we talked about that last time. Where's the mediastinum at? What does it separate? It's in the thoracic cavity, but what's it separating? It's separating the right and left pleural cavities from each other, right? So the mediastinum is right smack in the middle. All right, so let me show you a little bit. So here is a good picture of the lymphatic system. Okay, so the thymus gland is about in this region right here. All of these vessels are neither arteries or veins. These are lymphatic vessels that are carrying lymph. And it carries lymph from extremities back up to the heart. And before lymph goes back to the heart, it's got to be filtered by at least one lymph node right here so that impurities can be taken out of it or infectious material taken out of the lymph. And here's the spleen behind the stomach. That's an important lymph gland. Okay, so the important function, one important function of the lymphatic system. Let me expand this a little bit. Oh, I'm in a strange mode right here. Let's go to this mode right here and look at this picture. All right, so here is just an illustration. Here is your heart. Here is a blood vessel that's taking blood away from the heart, so this has got to be an artery, and it's red. So what kind of artery is that, a systemic or pulmonary? Systemic, right, because systemic arteries are high in oxygen. And it goes to a capillary bed. And what can you tell me about capillaries? All kinds of stuff can leak out of it, so you see things leaking out of the capillaries right here, and then blood returns back to the heart via this vein. Now, a lot of fluid leaks out on the proximal end of a capillary bed, and then some of it gets resorbed at the distal end over here. So if you were to think of all the capillaries in your body all day long, there are about 30 liters of plasma that leave your cardiovascular system and start to flow around all of your cells inside your body. So how many liters is 30 liters? What is that right there? Is that a liter and a half or is that 1 liter? That's a liter and a half, right? Well, let's pretend it's a liter. You'd have 30 of those things leaking out of your blood every day. So what would happen to your cardiovascular system, or what would happen to you if those 30 liters stayed out of your cardiovascular system? Well, you'd dehydrate in just a couple minutes, right? Because that's a huge amount of fluid. Now, some of it is resorbed. 27 liters get resorbed, but 3 liters does not. It gets lost someplace in your body. So it's to those containers every day. So if that doesn't return to your cardiovascular system, what happens to your body? The first day, it gets bigger by 2 of those bottles. The next day, 2 more of those bottles. Your body gets bigger. And then you do what? You just progressively swell up more and more and more every single day. We call that edema. So the job of the lymphatic blood vessels right here, the lymphatic system, is to capture that fluid that gets left over, those 3 liters, and returns it to a subclavian vein so that you don't swell up every day. So that's an important function of the lymphatic tissue. It gathers excess extracellular fluid and returns it to your cardiovascular system so that you don't dehydrate, number one, and number two, so that you don't swell up. So that's its big job. Okay, and these lymph nodes then, of course, filter stuff out of lymph as it's returning to the heart, like maybe bacteria or cancer cells. And that's why sometimes when somebody has cancer, these lymph nodes are loaded with cancer cells. And then what do we do with those lymph nodes, if you can tell? They're removed from the body so those cancer cells don't spread, right? And then these lymphatic vessels get pulled along with this node right here, or they're damaged. so that lymph can't return, at least from that part of the body, back to the subclavian vein. Well, so what's one of the side effects of removing lymph nodes from somebody? What did we say it was one of the job of the lymphatic system is to return fluid back to the blood to prevent swelling or edema. But if those lymphatic vessels are removed, what happens? That part of the body swells up, okay, because fluid is not being returned to the subclavian vein. That's just a side effect of the surgery. But what would you rather have if you had a choice? Cancer cells that could wander around in your body that could move from this lymph node to your brain or liver or bone, or to have swelling in some part of your body? That's just an unfortunate side effect, but everybody just, you know, of course, agrees to that, right, ahead of time. Okay. The other thing you notice is that this lymphatic fluid is at very low pressure. It has trouble moving back to the heart, just like venous blood does, but there's something in veins that maintains that blood only flows back to the heart. It can't flow back to an extremity. It has valves. And if we look at these little bulges right here in lymphatic vessels, we see that it has valves as well. Okay, and so now you know all of the cardiovascular structures that have valves, and there are three of them. So what kind of structures have valves in your body? Veins, number one. Arteries, I don't think arteries have valves. The heart, if you're thinking the heart valves as being right at the root of the aorta, I could see where you would say that, but typically arteries don't have valves. Right at the root of the aorta, there's one. Right at the root of the pulmonary trunk, there's one. But we usually attribute that to the heart itself. So I would consider that a heart valve more than an artery valve. All right, so the heart has valves, and you know four of them. Veins have valves, and lymphatic vessels have valves for maintaining flow going back to the heart. Okay, the other thing that lymphatic tissue does is that it absorbs fats from our diet. There are special lymphatic vessels in our intestines that absorb lipids or fats, and we call those lacteals. And when a lacteal absorbs fat, okay, it kind of looks like a milky white substance. We call that chyle. And also another function of the lymphatic system is that it's important for self-defense. It can identify foreign substances like bacteria and viruses, and it can build a defense, it can learn to recognize them, and then build antibodies that can kill those particular substances. And lymphocytes do that job. And lymph nodes filter lymph. The spleen, on the other hand, doesn't filter lymph, but there's a lot of blood that goes through the spleen, and it's responsible for filtering blood, looking for those same kinds of pathogens in blood. So lymph nodes filter lymph and the spleen filters blood. They both contain lymphocytes that can fight infection. Okay. There is lymphatic tissue all over the body, not just in lymph nodes, right? And it's associated with all kinds of mucosa linings. Where do you find a mucosa in your body? It's lining what? A mucosa lines a cavity that's what? Open to the outside world, right? A serous lining is what? Open is lining a cavity that's not open to the outside world, like the pleural cavity or something. All right, so what about your digestive tract? Is that open to the outside world? Yeah, on both ends. What about respiratory tract? Yeah, on one end, right? Your nose right there. All right, and so all kinds of pathogens can get inside your body through your nose, through your mouth, or other kinds of orifices that are open to the outside world. So there's special lymphatic tissue in these different mucosal linings, and so it's called mucosa-associated lymphoid tissue, or MALT. And it's just aggregations of lymphatic tissue in all different parts of your body that protect you from getting infections from your respiratory tract and oral cavity and digestive tract, right? And sometimes we just call that MALT, right? So it's in the digestive tract, respiratory tract, urinary tract, I forgot that, reproductive tract, that's right, all contain these various centers to fight infection. All right, so let's talk about each of these structures a little bit, starting with lymphatic vessels. So it's sort of like a blood vessel, okay, and what did we see on this slide over here? Which way is it taking lymph? Is it to the heart or away from the heart? To the heart. So what does that remind you of, an artery or a vein? A vein, right? So lymphatic vessels act very much like veins, except they don't carry blood. they just carry like tissue fluid or stuff that we would consider plasma, right, which we call lymph. It's just a straw-colored fluid. Okay, and where does lymph begins? All right, where does it begin? So on the slide over here, way on the right, we see a red vessel that signifies a artery, and then we see this branch right here. These are capillaries for exchange. This is where fluid leaks out. And then over here, this blue vessel, that's a vein bringing blood back to the heart. And remember, there's a lot of leftover fluid that can't get picked up by this distal end of a capillary, but it gets absorbed by these finger-like projections right here. This is the beginning of a lymphatic vessel. So it's not a complete circulatory system. It's not a circular system like the blood flows through. It begins in these vessels right here that we call lymphatic capillaries. And these lymphatic capillaries have little flaps that open and close. And when they open and close, they like swallow up extracellular tissue fluid and place it in this vessel. And then it starts to make its way back to the heart, okay, just like venous blood does. And it doesn't go back to an extremity because these things have valves in them. So a good example of what a lymphatic capillary looks like, if we really look in fine detail, here is the dead end of a lymphatic capillary, and here is a little flap-like mini valve that can open and close, and it's like swallowing excess fluid that builds up in different parts of your body, preventing that part from swelling up, and then it makes its way back to the heart. Okay. All right, don't forget, lymphatic vessels contain valves to prevent retrograde flow. The lymphatic system also has smooth muscle that can compress the wall of a lymphatic vessel, pressurizing it, and that will help squirt lymph back up to the heart. And did we talk about the skeletal muscle pump for venous return? I think maybe we did. Okay. But maybe I'll talk about it again. And just to let me go back to a previous slide right here. All right, so here we have a lymphatic vessel, a segment of a lymphatic vessel right here. And let's just say this is going through a skeletal muscle on either side of this lymphatic vessel. And we can see that there are some valves up over here. And let's just say there's some valves down over here. When this muscle contracts right here, okay, what happens to a muscle when it contracts? I'll demonstrate. It does what? It bulges, right? And it gets really thick. And it's going to compress this lymphatic vessel right here. All right, so think of a balloon. Grab a balloon and squeeze a balloon. What happens to the pressure inside that balloon? Does it go up or down or stay the same? It goes up, right? And fluid will always flow from high pressure to low pressure. So as this area here gets squeezed because a muscle contracts, right, this lymph is going to want to flow up to the heart because it's lower pressure here, and maybe flow back down to this extremity because there's lower pressure right here. But which way does it go? It only goes back to the heart because there are valves that prevent that retrograde flow. So anytime you contract muscles in your body, you are helping venous return. Blood and veins return to the heart, but also lymph that's in lymphatic vessels return to the heart as well. So we call that the skeletal muscle pump. All right, there's something else that happens too. So not only does fluid flow from high pressure to low, okay, so does a gas. Like air is a gas. And as you know, when we breathe, gas flows. Uh-oh, I'm losing my voice again. Gas is going to flow in your lungs and out of your lungs. How does it do that? Due to pressure changes, right? So how does a gas flow or a fluid flow? It does by pressure. How does the pressure have to be arranged? Mm-hmm. It always goes from high pressure to low. So in order to get air in your lungs, okay, we expand our thoracic cavity. We make our thoracic cavity bigger. That decreases the pressure in our lungs. So which way does air flow when the pressure in our lungs is low? It flows in, okay? And when we compress our chest, that pressurizes air in our lungs, that's higher than the atmosphere, which way does it go? It goes out. It goes from the lungs back into the surroundings, right? So it works by pressure changes. All right. So if we expand our thoracic cavity, so it's low pressure in our thorax, so air goes in, guess what else goes into our thoracic cavity? Not only air into our lungs, but venous blood gets drawn into the thoracic cavity, and lymph also gets drawn into the thorax because it's lower pressure, just due to breathing. So we call that the respiratory pump, or pressure changes in the thorax during breathing helps return blood as well as lymph back to the heart, because where's your heart? It's in the thorax, right? It's in the thoracic cavity. So just the act of breathing helps return these fluids back to the heart. Okay. Well, a lot of places in this class, we see that there is a lot of bilateral symmetry. And by that I mean, if you have a thumb on one side of your body, what do you have on the other? You got a thumb, right? Or you got a hand on one side, you got a hand on the other. You got an arm on one side, you got a hand on the other. If you got an eyeball on one side of your body, what do you got on the other? You got an eyeball, right? So we call that bilateral symmetry. But we saw in the last chapter that there is not always bilateral symmetry, like around the heart. Where did you see that deviation from that pure symmetry? The pure bilateral symmetry. What about the arch of the aorta? What can you remember about the arch? How many blood vessels are coming off the arch? Oh, it's three. There aren't four. There's three. So the brachiocephalic is really doing the job of what? The next two, right? So the brachiocephalic feeds the right side of the brain and arm, and then the next two vessels is the left common carotid and left subclavian feeds the left side of the body. So it's highly asymmetric when we look at the heart. Okay, same thing for the lymphatic system. If we look at this model right here, we see that there's one system that drains lymph from the right arm and right chest, and then there's another lymphatic vessel that drains not blood, but lymph from everywhere else in the body. All right, so again, there's a high degree of asymmetry in these lymphatic vessels. So on the right side of the body, lymph drains into the lymphatic duct. Where is the lymphatic duct? I might have to zoom in. Okay, here it is right here. All right, and that drains into the subclavian vein. So the right lymphatic duct drains blood from the right upper appendage and the right thorax and the right side of the head. And then you can see as lymph is flowing through these vessels back to the heart, what does it have to pass through? A little lymph node right here and here and here, at least one lymph node in every case. Okay, but the left side of the body, the whole left side of the body, and even the right abdomen and right lower appendage drain back through the thoracic duct, which is right here, which then goes to the left subclavian. All right, so there's a high degree of asymmetry. So this little collecting basin right here is called the cisterna chyli, which then drains lymph into the thoracic duct, which then takes it back to the left subclavian vein. All right, and everything else from the right lymphatic duct drains into the right subclavian vein right here. Okay, so I think this is an exam figure right here. Okay, lymphatic organs contain lymphatic tissue. So what does that mean? It contains lymphocytes. And right here, maybe you should just draw a little arrow to remind yourself what a lymphocyte does. What does it produce? Well, one kind of lymphocyte produces antibodies, which can fight infections. So draw a little arrow saying it can make antibodies. Antibodies then are released into the blood and circulate everywhere in your body fighting infections. All right, another kind of lymphocyte is a contact killer. That means that it has to bump into a bacteria. When it bumps into a bacteria, it will lyse it. It will cause it to explode. So we call that a contact killer. All right, macrophages, on the other hand, are monocytes, which is kind of a white blood cell. These are important shapeshifters. They can change their shape and move by what we call diapedesis. It can crawl around between cells. It can crawl out of the blood, and when it crawls out of a blood vessel, it becomes a macrophage. And when it bumps into a foreign substance, it will surround that foreign substance and phagocytize it and then It will perform a couple functions. One might be to kill that particular bacteria, but it can also help instruct lymphocytes how to identify it and kill it by producing antibodies. All right, so all of these things happen in lymphatic organs. Like what is, give me the name of a lymphatic organ. How about a, like a lymph node over here? Or MALT, which is associated with all mucosal linings of your what? Digestive tract, nasal cavity, etc., etc. Lymphocytes arise from bone marrow, and then they're carried by blood to various lymphatic organs. Oh, the thymus is another one. Okay? And when a microorganism gets inside your body, they stimulate lymphocyte cell division. And so what does germination mean? In order to understand germinal centers, what does anybody know what germination means? It doesn't have a really good meaning in physiology, but has a much better meaning in terms of botany. Like if you have a seed and you plant it in the ground, it starts to grow. That's what we call germination, right? So a seed will change its structure, it's going to start growing. So what process does it have to undergo when it is something really small and it gets big? And that happened to you. We looked at that maybe the first or second week. What is that process where you have maybe one cell and then you got two? And then you got four, all right? And then you got eight, and then 16. So what's happening to you? You're getting bigger. So how do you get bigger? What's that process by which you get bigger? That is mitosis, right? That's exactly right. So when something is germinating, it's undergoing mitosis. Cells are proliferating. So these germinal centers right here are centers for growth of lymphatic cells, which primarily can do what? Fight infection. So germinal centers are located in lymph nodes along all these different regions of a lymphatic vessel, in your tonsils, okay? And we're going to see that there's three sets of tonsils in your pharynx, but also all MALT, all mucosal linings in your body also have germinal centers as well, right? And so when your immune system, these germinal centers become activated when a microorganism is implanted in them, we call that immune system activation. So when does your immune system become activated? When you're in a sterile environment, completely healthy, or when? No, when you're outside, right? Or maybe you come to class and everybody starts sneezing and coughing on you and all those bacteria then get inside your body. That's when your immune system becomes activated. So how does it become activated? Because those bacteria, right, end up in these germinal centers like lymph nodes or your tonsils, and then they activate the immune system when that happens. So, okay, germinal centers is where immune system activation happens. And as a matter of fact, when you have an infection sometimes, a physician might actually palpate these lymph nodes on your body. There's three locations where they're very superficial and they can be palpated with your fingertips. And I see you're showing me right there. There are some in your cervical region right here, in your axillary region and inguinal region right here. So that's maybe an easy, oh, you're checking them out too. So that's a way for a physician to tell what the extent of an infection is, if it's localized to one part of your body or if it's more systemic, right? Just by palpating. And since what's happening, mitosis is happening, right? Since it's a germinal center, they enlarge, they swell up, and they actually feel kind of sore when that happens. Maybe you could recall that if you ever had an infection. Okay, tonsils in your pharynx over here. You got three of them. And I think we have to get to the respiratory chapter for me to actually show you where those are. I don't know if we're not going to have time for me to go to the respiratory chapter, but there's three locations for tonsils. Okay, palatines are in the posterior oral cavity. So if you look in the mirror and open your mouth, what cavity are you looking at? Your oral cavity, right? And then if you stick your tongue out and go, ah, you can see those tonsils if you still have them back in the posterior wall, right? Pharyngeal tonsils, they're up in the nasal cavity. If you open your mouth, can you see your nasal cavity? No, you can't. You need special little instruments to look around in there, right? And then also we have a couple of lingual tonsils way down at the base of the tongue, and those are difficult to see too if you look in the mirror. So the only ones you can really see are the palatines. And these again, are germinal centers. When bacteria are presented to these tonsils, they figure out a way, hopefully, to kill those bacteria and prevent an infection in your body. But every once in a while, these tonsils, because one of their jobs is to gather bacteria up and kill them, they gather bacteria and the bacteria get the better end of the deal. They learn to live in a tonsil. So these tonsils might become chronically infected when that happens. The immune system isn't strong enough to completely kill that infection. So when somebody has a chronically infected tonsil like these palatines over here, they will have a sore throat maybe every couple weeks. And it might be a bad sore throat to where they can't go to work or school or whatever. And then they get over it, and then another couple weeks you get another sore throat. So what would that be like? Well, it's a real drag, okay? When somebody has a chronically inflamed or infected tonsil. And a good way to treat that is by ablating that tonsil, which we call what, a tonsillectomy. And that happens to children fairly often. When children go through a tonsillectomy, it's a fairly easy procedure. Probably right after the procedure, after anesthesia, they're up and want to go play and they want to eat ice cream and have a good time, horse around. Right, so they're out of the hospital pretty quick. But as an adult, it's a pretty difficult kind of procedure because by that time, your tonsils are sort of as big as the tip of your thumbs right here, right? And they're in the back of your throat. So can you imagine taking like an ice cream scooper and scooping out tissue in some part of your body as big as the tip of your thumb right here? How would it feel? Really sore and miserable. So for an adult, guess what? You get 2 weeks off of work to recuperate. So it's a fairly long recuperative period. So a lot of adults don't really like to go through that procedure, but you know, I think it's a really good deal. Instead of having a sore throat twice a month, you might not have a sore throat for a couple of years. That will really completely change your life when you have an chronically infected tonsil. So it's a good thing to go through. Okay. All right, so that's it for today. Next time we'll say something about lymph nodes and that. Oh, next time is the test. Sorry about that. Okay, so don't forget the sign-in sheet. It's going around someplace. And we'll see you guys Monday. Blackboard is back up and working. So I think you had a deadline of last night, not tonight, in this class. Was it last night or Thursday? I forget when it is. But anyway, it's back up and working, so all the modules are available for you to study for the test.